Let's resume our study in the book of Daniel, chapter number 10, where the prophet Daniel, no doubt being frustrated by the suspension of the rebuilding of the temple of Jerusalem, has gone on an extended fast. 3 weeks he's gone without food, praying to God to respond to him, to give him some sort of understanding of what's supposed to happen next for the Jewish people. Because Daniel has been in exile for over 70 years now, and the book of Jeremiah had said that the desolation would end after 70 years. And while some of the people are going back to Judea, and that's part of the end of the desolation, the temple is not being built right now. It is being impeded by the efforts of the Samaritans and others within the Medo-Persian bureaucracy. So Daniel is at a loss, and he prays, and then something breaks loose 3 weeks into his prayer session. A being shows up. I think it's probably the Archangel Gabriel. But others think it might have been Jesus himself in a pre-Bethlehem visitation. But regardless, this being is so radiant, so magnificent in appearance and sound, that Daniel pretty much passes out. And the people that are with Daniel, who only sense the presence of this being, they run away in fear. And so we pick it up in Daniel chapter 10, verse number 10, where it says, "Behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees." So Daniel had been flat out, but now he's back up on all fours. Verse 11, "He said to me, O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you. Stand upright. For now I've been sent to you." And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. So now he's upright again. Then he said to me, "Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. But Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I was left there with the kings of Persia, to come to make you understand what is to happen to your people in the later days, for the vision is for days yet to come." So this angelic being, for that's who I think it is, tells Daniel, "I was dispatched immediately upon you starting your time of mourning and fasting and prayer 21 days ago." So that'd be back on the fifth day of the first month of this Jewish year. So translates into about 24 March of 535 BC is when Daniel started his fast. And so here we are in May of that same year. And Daniel is weak from hunger, but also from the grief in his heart over the fact that even after a year's time since the founding of the Second Temple, the building is not happening. And so the angelic being explains, "I was delayed because of spiritual warfare." When he mentions here the prince of the kingdom of Persia, that's not a human being. Paul talks about this. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood. It's against principalities and powers, against these world rulers of darkness in the heavenly regions, in the unseen world, if you will. So this spiritual warfare is going on all the time. It does seem to be regional, as is described here. And so the evil fallen angels, particularly one fallen angel that's in control of the Persian region, had barricaded God's messenger from getting into Daniel during this time period until another angelic being, Michael, the archangel of the Jewish people, or of the covenant. He is dispatched to help break through this barricade, get the message into Daniel, because the people under Daniel's leadership need to hear what the future holds. And so this becomes a bit of a history lesson in advance of what has to happen until a crisis is overcome in Israeli history. And I cannot stress enough how important Daniel chapters 10, 11, and 12 are for the Jewish people to get them through the second century BC crisis that has the temple, the new temple that's getting to be rebuilt right now, that temple shut down for a period of time, and it almost looks as if the Jewish faith is going to be eradicated from the earth. That's a major crisis in the second century BC. These bits of history ahead of time that God gives in prophecy helps a certain group of people fight back against that and overcome it. We know them as the Maccabees, and the whole history of Hanukkah takes place in fulfillment of a key portion of this prophecy that we're looking at right now. So this is a very, very important bit of prophecy for us to be aware of. So Daniel is told, I got in here by supernatural invasion assistance from Michael. Now, he's there to tell him the future history. Verse 15, when he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and was mute. So he couldn't even talk back at this point. Behold, one in the likeness of the children of man touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and I spoke. I said to him who stood before me, oh, my Lord, by reason of the vision, pains have come upon me, and I retain no strength. How can my Lord's servant talk to my Lord? For now no strength remains in me, and no breath is left in me. So Daniel is actually acknowledging here he is in a mess physically at this point. He's in his 90s. And he is having a hard time with the emotion of all of this, plus the fact that he's gone 3 weeks without eating. He needs assistance. So verse 18, again, one having the appearance of a man touched me and strengthened me. He said, O man, greatly loved, fear not. Peace be with you. Be strong and of good courage. So he's being encouraged by this angelic being. As he spoke to me, I was strengthened. And then I said, let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. So now Daniel's ready to receive the information. He's ready to get it into his mind and then write it down for the benefit of the Jewish people that will follow Daniel and for us today so that we can see the power of prophecy. The power of prophecy is twofold. Number one, it proves that God is outside of time. He knows past, present, and future with no problems. And so that's why he can give specific information about the future, because it's just known to him. And then the other important part of prophecy, the power of prophecy, is that it helps get people of faith in particular through a time of crisis. And when you know how it's all going to play out, it helps you hang in there. And so that's what Daniel is about to be given. Verse 20. And then he said to me, do you know why I've come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. So this angelic being tells Daniel, look, you know that I'm here to deliver a message, which I'm about to do. But once I finish giving you this message, I have to fight my way back out of here again because I've got other things to take care of for God. And sometime after I'm gone, the Prince of Greece is going to be coming this direction. Now, this is not the human Prince of Greece. This is the supernatural angelic being that has control in the supernatural realm near Greece. And it seems as if there's a little inter-rivalry that goes on between the fallen angels. Not surprising, we see something similar that happens in organized crime, where lower-level regional bosses will sometimes play against one another and even assassinate one another in order to get the control of a bigger piece of the action for themselves. So what we've got going on here is a little bit of that inner rivalry between the supernatural being in Persia and the supernatural being in Greece, and this will play into the fighting back and forth of the human components of those areas. And we know Greece is going to sweep over the Persian area during the time of Alexander the Great. We've seen that prophecy before. But here comes more of the message. I will tell you what is inscribed in the Book of Truth. So the Book of Truth here representing the information that God has, past, present, future. There is none who contends by my side against these except Michael, your prince. So in the supernatural warfare that goes on in the unseen world, it is this being, which I think is probably Gabriel, can't prove it, but I think it probably is, and Michael, the prince of the Jewish people, or I think more specifically, the prince of the covenant of God. Now comes the information. And this information is so precise that it has been claimed that a later person wrote these things down and pretended that they were from the time of Daniel. And that the reason they're so precise is because they're after the fact. Now, I totally disagree with that. The people who make that claim try to strip away the point of prophecy is to prove that God is the God of past, present, and future and knows everything with precision. And besides that, we are aware historically that the entire book of Daniel was translated from Aramaic, Hebrew, into Greek right around 285 BC. So we know that this book of Daniel, including this section, was in the Greek language in the 3rd century BC. And yet quite a few of the events that are written with precision about in this section happen later than that by quite a bit. I have tried my best to provide a detailed accounting of these historical events in a little handout that I do for my classes. And I will try to attach that to the audio file of this teaching online, intotheword.net. And that way you can pull it down and take your own time to go through it. The handout is done in the King James Version because that doesn't have any type of, it's in public domain, so I don't have any copyright restrictions on using it. But I'm going to try my best as we go through our English Standard Version in our study time to read to you from my notes what the historical events are, and I'll give you the precise dates and names of persons involved in it. Okay? So here we go. Chapter number 11. As for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede. Now, Darius the Mede is the guy that was the point man of the Medo-Persian Empire taking over the Babylonian Empire. That all happened in 538 BC. That's recent history for Daniel. Very recent history, just the last few years. So in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. So to support him in assisting the transfer from the Babylon Empire to the Medo-Persian Empire. Verse 2. Now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia. Here are their names in order: Cambyses, Pseudosmerdis, and Darius. Now he continues. A fourth shall be far richer than all of them. That fourth king, we know him as King Xerxes, who ruled from 485 to 465 BC. He's the guy that ends up being married to Esther. And yes, he was a lot richer than the three guys that came before him. Continuing with verse 2. When he has become strong through his riches, he will stir up all the kingdom of Greece. And we know that in 478 BC, Xerxes attempted an invasion of the Greek homelands. And it was a disaster. He mustered together, according to the ancient writings, something like a million-man army. And before it was all finished, he'd lost half of them. He had thousands of ships that were involved in this, and he lost most of those. It was horrendous. And it's not a surprise at all in the book of Esther that when he got back from this expedition, that people in his own land wanted to kill him. You might remember in the book of Esther, which we haven't got to yet this time around, Mordecai actually saves King Xerxes from a plot against him. And so that's all related to his disastrous attempt to take over the Greek homelands. Now, what's the response from that? The Greeks were never forgetting that attempt by the Persians to take over. And so when they get the opportunity, they push eastward and start taking over Persian lands until we have a guy by the name of Alexander the Great who sweeps across and totally takes over the Persian homelands and the Persian Empire. And that's all going to happen in 336 through 323 BC. But it's mentioned right here. It says, verse 3, then a mighty king shall arise, that's Alexander the Great, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he is risen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided into the four toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. And this is what we know. Alexander died young. He was only 33, I think, when he dies in 323 BC. He has one small child, I mean an infant, that could have taken over his kingdom in his stead, but that doesn't happen. Instead, four of Alexander's generals split up the kingdom of Alexander. Those generals were Cassander, who ends up taking over the region of Macedonia and its related territories, Lysimachus, who ends up taking over Thrace and its related territories, and then the two that were most connected to in the rest of this study. Ptolemy took the land of Egypt and its related territories, and he actually had Syria to begin with. But eventually, a fourth guy by the name of Seleucus takes over Syria and its related territories. So that's the four kingdoms, the four Greek or Macedonian kingdoms that arose from the time of Alexander. And none of them were related to Alexander, just like it says here in the text. So we've got great precision in everything we've read so far. Now, verse 5. The king of the south shall be strong. From here on out, the kingdom south of Judea, so that would be the kingdom in Egypt, the Macedonian kingdom in Egypt, which was started by Ptolemy, which is why it's referred to in history books as the Ptolemaic kingdom. That's always going to be referred to in these sections of Daniel as the king of the south. And so the first king of the south was Ptolemy the first, who ruled from 323 to 285 BC. And then all of his descendants will be the later kings of the south. But then verse 5 continues. One of his princes, that is Ptolemy's princes, one of Ptolemy's clients, shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. Now that guy is Seleucus the first, and that's why the kingdom north of Judah, referred to as the king of the north, is the Seleucid kingdom, because it's named after this guy. Now he started out being, as I said, a client of Ptolemy. But Ptolemy helped him kind of take over a certain portion of Syria. And once Seleucus I had that, he exploded into other areas nearby and became very powerful. And eventually, that kingdom will take over even larger areas than the Ptolemaic kingdom has, which is why it becomes stronger. In fact, it will take the promised land region away from the Ptolemaic kingdom. So now we've got the two kingdoms that are bracketing the promised land. We've got the Ptolemaic kingdom in the south and the Seleucid kingdom to the north. Verse number 6. After some years, they shall make an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. Now this is Bernice, or Bernice, some of you know the pronunciation as, who is the daughter of Ptolemy the second. And she ends up being kind of in some sort of marital agreement with Antiochus the second, up in Syria. Now, what happens next? It says, but she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her and he who supported her in those times. Now, what happens is, another woman comes into the story at this point, Laodice, whom Antiochus II had divorced in order to marry Bernice from Egypt, conspired against both of them and had them killed. And so the whole marital alliance between the king of the north and the king of the south fell apart. What happens after that? Verse 7. But from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place. Now, what that means is Bernice's brother, Ptolemy the Third, he comes into the picture next. What does it say in the text will happen? He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with them and shall prevail. So he invades the northern kingdom of Seleucus the Second. And he basically avenges the death of his sister by killing Laodice. Verse number 18. He shall also carry off to Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold, and for some years he shall refrain from attacking the king of the north. So he is satisfied with plundering the northern kingdom of all their goodies, including their idols. Then it says, make sure I'm in the right spot here, verse number nine. Then the latter shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. What happens is, Ptolemy the third is the next guy who becomes the king of southern lands of the Egyptian kingdom. Verse number 10. His sons, meaning Seleucus the third or the second, his sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. So now you've got two brothers in a row that get all stirred up from the north, from Seleucus' kingdom. This is Seleucus III, followed by Antiochus III, and they keep trying to take over the kingdom of the Ptolemies. They keep pushing south. And eventually, the Promised Land comes into the frame here as being what the northern kingdom wants to take over, because it had been in the orbit of the Egyptians ever since the breakup of Alexander's kingdom. And so we've run out of time today. So tomorrow we'll pick up here and talk about how Judea suddenly shifts from the orbit of Ptolemaic Egypt into the orbit of Syrian Seleucid kingdom.